have a different reading today. It's not related to the theme, except on the first Sunday of the month, we've often emphasized membership and welcoming new people. This was brought to my attention by Lori Fermicella, who is a new member of our church. It's from a book entitled It Takes a Worried Man, a book I have not read. It's fairly new. It's by Brendan Halperin. And it's a true story of a teacher in the Boston area who attends a Unitarian Universalist church. And he tells his perspective in the book about confronting his wife's breast cancer. But the portion I'm going to read is about the church's coffee hour. And this is where he found his wife's doctor. And this is a reminder that during the coffee hour, when people have a red cup, we really should talk to them. Now, as I look around, there aren't that many guests today, so that we're all going to be all charged up to talk to our guests, and there'll be no guests to talk to. But we can talk to one another. So I think you might find this interesting, and he talks about this experience. I think once again about how lucky we are to have on Kristen's case, and then I think that it might not have all had to do with luck. In some strange way, having Dr. J in charge of Kristen's treatment is the result of some small nice thing I did years ago. Kristen and I were on the membership committee at church, and one of the things we were working on was being more welcoming to newcomers. After church, we have this coffee hour thing where everybody socializes, and the people at our church are, as I keep saying, these really nice, kind, caring people. But everyone just ignores the newcomers, and they stand there, coffee in hand, with this pathetic, won't somebody please talk to me look on their faces, while all the nice, kind members of the church are running around talking to the other nice, kind people and leaving these new people feeling like the kid who didn't get picked for the kickball team. Now, I have become one of those people who ignore newcomers because I have to chase my son Rowan around, and I want to check in with the seven nice people that I only see on Sunday. And also, I spend so much time in church school that I've had a few embarrassing conversations where I go, so are you new here? And they answer, looking kind of annoyed, well, I've been coming for 6 months. But we met Dr. J pre-Rowan, and Kirsten and I remember all too painfully how horrible it was to stand there at coffee hour feeling invisible because we did it for weeks. So we made it our mission to talk to people we did not recognize. And one day, I wasn't really feeling like it because the fact is that these conversations are frequently vapid in the way that first conversations tend to be. So do you live in the neighborhood? What do you do for a living? It's an ironic feature of the Unitarian coffee hour that religion, which is, after all, the one thing you may have in common with someone you meet for the first time at church, is never discussed. This is partly, I think, because Unitarians are so afraid of offending anybody. We welcome everybody with a vaguely religious leaning into church, so you have Christians and Buddhists and even atheists all coming to the same church. So talking about religion can open up a can of worms. But also, I think it's that Unitarians tend to be college-educated liberals, and we are all sort of embarrassed by our religiosity. Like talking about God will immediately make us seem like one of those Bible-thumping, gay-hating, secretly dating a hooker guys you see on TV. Anyway, one morning I wasn't feeling like having an awkward conversation, but Kristen poked me in the ribs until I went to talk to this lady I didn't recognize, who turned out to be Dr. J. And as I mentioned, she was a church friend for years before she became Kristen's doctor. And she always says that my saying hi to her that one morning was the reason she joined the church, because she was on her third Sunday of standing there feeling stupid. And she said she had decided to never come back if someone didn't talk to her. And I did. In the middle of all this, that has made me question just about everything I and anyone else believes. Here is something good, something that makes sense. One day I did something nice, admittedly more out of sense of duty than sheer friendliness, and also to stop the sharp pain in my ribs. But still, I did something nice. And as a result, we have this incredibly bright and kind person in charge of the fight against Kristen's cancer. It's kind of humbling in a way. How often do we have opportunities to do nice little things, when we blow it off because someone isn't elbowing us to do it? So I encourage you during the coffee hour to talk to someone. Who knows? It may be a helpful doctor. This morning's topic is entitled Adaptation to Life. It's the first part of a two-part series I intend to do, and in many ways I thought it would be worthwhile to bring back Adaptation to Life. It's based on a book that was written 25 years ago by George Valiant. He is also the author of the book Aging Well, which he just published about a year ago. Adaptation to Life is based on a study of Harvard students, which began in 1942, and he was director of the study when he wrote the book. The original goal was to follow students throughout their lives to better determine how they would admit future students, but the project grew to be much larger, and it became a study of adult development and how people cope and adapt to their emerging life circumstances. The book is about the first 30 years of the study and following these lives. The book Aging Well then takes these lives 25 years later and talks about most of them when they're now in their 70s, looking back over their lives all the way from, in one study case, grade school, and in the Harvard case, their college years. This was done through beginning with their student health records, their academic performance and interviews, and then through all of that time period, they have filled out a questionnaire every 2 years, had a physical exam every 5 years, and been interviewed every 15 years. And the wives and children have been asked to respond as well. The study provides a movie of the lives, in other words, the entire life picture, rather than the usual snapshot, which is typical of most people's lives that we see. We only see an event. Since then, Valiant has added a study of men raised in poverty to balance those who attended Harvard, and also a study of West Coast women who were protected because they were particularly bright. Both studies are not as complete as the Harvard study, but they have the same longevity, and they are used in the work Aging Well. The original study was of men, and that's what I'll be talking about today by way of background, but the basic elements in the examples I use, I believe, apply to women as well. Adaptation to life is something everybody needs to do. I'm going to talk particularly about two people. In the book, there are many people who are discussed, and part of the success of the book is George Valiant's skill at writing. It's a little bit a combination of psychological insight and a novel about real-life people. He talks about these people as they face a variety of events in their lives. He talks about these two in particular. One adapted skillfully, and his name is David Goodhart. Now, he says the names are synonyms to protect the members of the study, and he kind of was inspired for his naming by Pilgrim's Progress. Again, real people, but their names have been changed. The other person, in contrast, his name is Carlton Terrytown, and he reported caused both difficulties for himself and others as he tried to adapt to life. Valiant writes about it this way. When I interviewed the men, they seemed very different. Mr. Goodhart had the look of a worried college president with slightly tousled hair, a rumpled raincoat, and an aristocratic bearing. His well-tailored suit and accent belied his Detroit working-class background. Having put himself to great inconvenience to keep the appointment, Mr. Goodhart went to special pains to buy me a cup of coffee. In manner, he was easy, open, relaxed, and warm. Although he made little eye contact, I got no feeling that Mr. Goodhart was cold, only shy. Everything that I do, he said, depends on personal relationships. The interview with Dr. Carlton Terrytown was painfully antiseptic. Terrytown talked to me in his Fort Lauderdale living room, a room so meticulously decorated that it reminded me of a house and garden advertisement, or because the realities of the adult world were so excluded, of a nursery. At 47, he looked 60, tall and cadaverous. Terrytown dressed immaculately, but he had lost that social patina that he had brought with him from private boarding school to college. Dr. Terrytown said that he did not depend upon other people. Rather, he boasted that his greatest satisfaction came from using his own head. Each of these men had adapted to life in different ways. But what does it mean to adapt to life? It's not what happens to each of us individually, because we do not know, but it's how each of us responds to events. Valiant's premise is that mental health requires adaptation. If we don't have the strength to accept the terms life offers us, we must, in self-defense, force our terms upon life. But if an individual or their environment are distorted too much in that process, the adaptation is unsuccessful and can be labeled mental illness. An example, a broken love affair. It can lead one person to write great poetry, another to commit suicide. Both are adaptive efforts, attempts to alter pain. Each adaptation in the individual, however, is not always in their full conscious control. The sources of our adaptations are not always known to us. We make choices, then these become habits, and then they become life patterns. Our psychological adaptations are not unlike our bodily adaptations. A fever is synonymous with disease. The body is adapting to the invading bacteria. Events in our lives require adaptation when conflicts arise. Basic elements of our inner life become threatened. Whether it's our instincts, our view of the world, the important people in our world, or a prohibition of conscience or culture. Adaptations are employed when we want to keep emotions within bearable limits during sudden life crises, such as following a death, to restore emotional balance by postponing or channeling sudden increases in biological drives, such as sexuality at puberty, to obtain a time out to master changes in self-image, such as following major surgery or an unexpected promotion or demotion, to handle unresolved conflicts with people living or dead whom one cannot bear to leave, such as the death of a loved one, and to survive major conflicts with conscience, such as killing in wartime or putting a reluctant parent into a nursing home. Unsuccessful and successful adaptations are not just responses to individual situations, but as the study finds out, they are habitual lifetime responses. What are some unsuccessful adaptations? One is projection, attributing one's problems to others. Another is passive aggression, channeling one's anger into unproductive activity. Another is disassociation, to not look realistically at one's problems. Another is acting out, responding like a child. What are some successful adaptations? Sublimation, turning bad situations to good. Humor, laugh at oneself and one's situation. Realism, see one's problems realistically. Suppression, which is in contrast to repression. Suppression is more conscious, being patient, looking at the bright side. And lastly, perspective, putting the situation in its proper place. Return to David Goodhart. He was the son of a prejudiced Detroit blue-collar worker raised in a blue-collar neighborhood. He became a consultant to the Ford Foundation on urban affairs. His adaptive style was altruism and sublimation. Carlton Tarrytown was a doctor in Florida, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, but he gave up his practice for state work. His motivation was security, not service, and he was a failure in his own eyes. He was lonely, he was alcoholic, and he came from a difficult emotional background. He had three failed marriages, and because of his alcoholism, was not allowed to see his children. His adaptive style was disassociation and projection. An example of the differences, Goodhart and Tarrytown, and remember these are real-life circumstances. A typical response to how they would respond differently when a situation occurs. Tarrytown's mother died. He left his medical practice and lost himself in a 2-week drinking spree and did not even attend the funeral. In contrast, Mr. Goodhart lost his best friend in a sailing mishap. He stopped what he was doing, took part in the rescue operations, pressed for search well beyond a reasonable time. In his own way, he could not face the loss, but he acted in constructive ways. Valiant writes, "An important difference between the two men lay in their unequal capacity to tolerate the reality of their parents' shortcomings. In adolescence, Mr. Goodhart was able to admit, albeit reluctantly, that his mother was very nervous, irritable, anxious, and a worrier. When he was 28, he reported that she had long-standing personality problems, and the available evidence supported his view. Dr. Terrytown, however, never wavered in his belief that his depressed and not always responsible mother was too good to be in this world. In fact, as a college sophomore whose own rampantly escapist behavior endangered his welfare, Terrytown tried very hard to take care of his sick mother, although she had once more abandoned him. Then and thereafter, he thought everyone in the world was out of step except his mother and himself. One of the most intriguing of the various people who responded in these various studies was a man who Valiant named Alan Poe. The Poe didn't meet any of the criteria. He was living poorly, but he was enjoying life. George Valiant writes of Poe, "He was a man as objectively troubled as Dr. Terrytown, but whom I respected as much as Mr. Goodhart." Poe wrote his reaction to the study in a long letter. He writes, "I read over the material that seemed to come down to having a good income, a stable family, a reasonable job satisfaction, a capacity to love, and a capacity to play. And the patient or subject or whatever we're calling him either adapts to achieve those end results, and that presumably good, or he doesn't adapt and doesn't get to those ends, and that's presumably bad. He either copes satisfactorily by mastering his life, or he limps along. I have two foggy concepts that you might want to churn around related to your study. One, I guess, you would call the celebrant sense, or that wonderful hippie word, wow. I get no such sense of celebration out of your portrait of Mr. Goodhart. Maybe it's there. Maybe it just wasn't a high value in your mind. But I think it's an important component in the whole adaptive process. Life needs to be enjoyed. The other component of adaption, which I think needs to be considered, is in my mind classified as the big discovery of my 50s. It's called by a lot of names, depending on your religious or philosophical or even mystical orientation. I call it empathy, or caring for others. The most profound finding of the study, and this was a psychological study, but it certainly validates the ancient message of all the world religions, that the ability to love and be loved is a crucial element in life's successful adaptations. A high percentage of the worst adaptations had no close friends in midlife. One wrote, "I don't know what the word friend means." Goodhart had several close friends. Terrytown had no friends and never did. Constant friendships also are related to loneliness. They are in contrast to one another. But there is a high correlation between the best and worst adaptations in the study, because the lonely are often frightened and they are paranoid. Valiant writes, "How strange that in real life the capacity to enjoy the holiday desert islands of our imagination should have been a privilege granted only to the friendly. 3/4 of the friendly took full vacations, but this was true for only 2 of the 13 lonely. Without real vacations, the lonely sought vacations from themselves, and so 3 times as many lonely men were heavy users of alcohol and tranquilizers." One member of the study, who was one of the worst adapters, said that his best friend was a war buddy, and the only connection he had with him was a half sentence at Christmas time, and he had not seen him in 14 years. He was equally removed from his family and had not seen his brothers and sisters in 30 years. Of the best adapters, most of them had close friends and close family relationships, and these gave them pleasure in their lives and also support in times of need. George Valiant writes of the effect the friendly people have on him while he's making the interviews. It shows the relationship that we continually have on others as we meet them. He writes, "I soon discovered that whether the men like me or not, or if whether I like them, had far more to do with their lives than with mine. The men who always found loving easy made me feel warmly toward them and led me to marvel at both my tact and my skill as an interviewer and at their good fortune to belong to such an enjoyable project. I left the office of one such man feeling 10 feet tall, but he had the same effect on all others throughout his life. In contrast, men who had spent their lives fearful of other people and had gone unloved in return often made me feel incompetent and clumsy. With them, I felt like a heartless investigator dissecting them for science. Adapting to life is our response to events, conflict, and crises. We seek solutions or adaptations. Some are successful and some are not. Adapting to life's complexities is demonstrated by the contrast between David Goodhart, son of a blue-collar worker who became a Ford Foundation consultant using effective adaptive forms, and Carlton Tarrytown, who became a doctor but lived a lonely alcoholic life using unsuccessful adaptive ways. Adapting to life is not fated by individual childhood traumas, but by continued destructive relationships. Age 30 is a better indicator of an individual's adaptive style than one's early years. Adapting to life is more than success in traditional terms, as Alan Poe reminds us. We also need empathy and joy. Adapting to life requires having loving relationships. A basic question for all of us is, how have we adapted? How do we adapt now? And is our form of adaptation working for us? If not, how can we change it? I conclude with three principles of adaptation that stand out for me from the overall study. Youthful behavior is not necessarily a predictor of adult action. Age 30 is a more reliable watershed. Realistic evaluation of one's life circumstance and of specific events is crucial. And lastly, the ability to love and be loved is a basic element in successful life adaptation. Nothing correlated with the best and worst adaptations more than the experience of friends and long-term intimate relationships. In other words, have love, seek understanding, and be loving.